All right, good morning. Thank you all for having me. Thank you, Ufuk and Philippe, for organizing this great conference. It's great to be here. So in the spirit of the college, I'm presenting some research in the making, work in progress, so it'd be great to get your feedback as we go along. This is joint work with Ufuk and Tom Nicholas, who's at Harvard, and it's entitled The Birth of American Ingenuity, Innovation, and Inventors of the Golden Age. Now this paper is really motivated by two things. First, there's been a large and growing theoretical literature on the determinants of long-run growth and the relationship between innovation and growth, dating back to, obviously, the famous Aguirre and Howitt and Romer models back in the early 90s. And it's commonly accepted nowadays that long-run growth is indeed driven by innovation and technical change. However, the empirical work has been relatively recent in nature. You know, we've been using data from the past 10 or 20 years. And there is little work that's been over truly the long run, the last 100 years or so. And little is known about the actual creators, the inventors of these new ideas, the people who drive this growth. And so this is an empirical paper that tries to shed light on the link between innovation and truly long run, 100-year long growth. And then we use some new data to exhibit the characteristics of the fathers of American ingenuity, the inventors who created the new innovations, and the environment in which they were born. So in order to do this, obviously it's an empirical paper, we need to have good data, and this has been a major part of this effort, is to collect some great new micro data on regional as well as individual performance during what's called the Golden Age of Innovation, according to Bob Gordon. So we've gone back and we've taken newly released decennial census data from 1880 to 1940. So we have information on every individual who lived in the United States in every 10 years from 1880 to 1940. And we've matched that to the universe of patents granted by the US Patent Office from 1836 through 2004. And this has been quite a painstaking process through a combination of hand entry techniques and machine learning optical character recognition, or OCR, techniques. And then given this matched data set, we aim to present some new key facts regarding the relationship between innovation and growth and the characteristics of the people who really led this innovation. So by way of further motivation, I want to give you a couple of examples of the true superstars of American innovation during the early 20th century. So Thomas Edison is obviously a household name, a very well-known individual. He's the inventor of the light bulb, as well as numerous other things. He holds over 1,000 patents. He was born in Ohio and was born to a relatively poor family. He had to borrow to first finance his innovations. In fact, he sold 20 out of his first 25 patents in order to raise the funds to start mass-producing innovations. Once he had these funds, he decided he needed to move somewhere with a larger market, with more great ideas, more people. So he built the Menlo Park Lab in New Jersey, right next to the New York City metropolitan area, in order to take advantage of the vast array of intelligent, high human capital workers there. Melvin de Groot is the inventor of something we all know and love, the founder of the chemicals used in creating chocolate ice cream. He was also an incredibly prolific man. He holds over 900 patents. He's, I think, the third most prolific American inventor. And he got 2 degrees in chemical engineering from Ohio State University. He was a highly educated individual. Nikola Tesla, on the other hand, he's famous for the alternating current as well as a number of other important electrical engineering advances. He was a college dropout, so he was not an especially well-educated individual, at least formally. He was also an immigrant from Croatia. He was asocial, never married. His work was really his romance, if you will. So I show you these three examples for two reasons. First, I want you to have a frame of reference for these real household names that are going to be in our data set. And these are the kinds of inventions that we're going to be considering, or these really fundamental things to the way we live today. But the other reason I show you these things, these three examples, is that these three people had very different life cycles. Education's different in terms of migration; they're different in terms of, in terms of their financial well-being, they've been quite different. And so, What our study does that I think you will get, you'll get more out of our study relative to just reading a couple of biographies, is if you were just to read a biography of Thomas Edison, for instance, or only a biography of Nikola Tesla, you would conclude that perhaps education isn't so important. Maybe there's something about creativity. And so it's very important that we have a more systematic approach to understand what drives innovation at the individual level and at the more aggregate level. So before I proceed, I want to mention a disclaimer. We are just trying to present some interesting correlations, some new facts. We do not try to claim too many things are causal, and I think there's plenty of scope for future research on this point, so be excited for the future. So now I'm going to talk in more depth about the data that we have. So as I mentioned, we have the complete count census data from 1880 and 1900 through 1940 in the U.S. Now, the reason why this has only been able to be a study today is that the census is released with a 70-year lag, and 1940 is the first census which has had a number of new variables that we really are excited about. Every census contains information on the name, the residence, age, race, sex, marital status, occupation, and birthplace of everyone in the U.S., but in 1940, we also observe income, education, and labor force status, which are things that we are obviously very interested in for these people. We also can match people to their parents if they live in the same household by using household identifiers and surnames and some of the relationships to the household had variables, so we actually can have some information on the parents as well. Unfortunately, the 1890 census was burned in a fire, so there's a slight gap there. Shows you how much we had to actually hand code some of these things and use some interesting techniques. We match those to patent documents provided by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, USPTO, from 1836 to 2004. We have information on the patent class, the number of citations it received, where it was filed, when it was granted, to whom it was assigned. So, you know, there might be an inventor and a company that actually owns the rights to the patent afterwards. That's the assignee. And for the decennial census years and from 1920 on, we also have the inventor names. So using the names in the patent documents and using the census information, we can match and try to determine who actually are the inventors in the U.S. at the time. And so as an example of that, I want to just show you exactly how we do this. So this is Thomas Edison's electric lamp patent, obviously a piece of history here. In our census data, looks like this. So we have first name, surname, the year of the census, age, marital status, et cetera, and importantly, location. So what we can do is we take the name and we match the name in the census to the name on the patent. Now obviously there might be several Thomas Edisons in the United States, so going on there we also have to say, well, this person is living in a particular place in 1880, which you can see both in the census data and on the patent, and in Menlo Park, New Jersey. So through these, through location, name, and year, we have a fairly robust match between individuals in the census data and individuals on the patent records. So to summarize, we're going to limit ourselves to the working age population in the continental US, so not Alaska or Hawaii, because those weren't actually states in 1880. We have over 320 million individual observations, a large data set, with 63,000 inventors and 380,000 patents. So this is the first time, I think, that we've been able to have this matched data set, which will really allow a systematic analysis of inventors and innovation over the long run in the United States. So just to set the stage, I'm going to give you a brief history in 159 years of American innovation. So in 1841, you can see basically that all of the innovation, all the patents were being filed in the northeast of the United States, which is, of course, where all the human capital was, where finance was developed, et cetera, et cetera. And as I run this forward, you'll see that innovation will start to flow out to the Rust Belt, where all the industry started to begin at around the same time, you know, Illinois and Michigan. And then during the Gold Rush in California and Denver, we start to see more transport going out there, and innovation follows. And from there, so too does industrial growth. And then as we get more into the modern era, we can see that, in fact, the dark red spaces are exactly where we consider the most innovative areas now, places like San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, and Boston, among others. So that's a 159-year history lesson for you in about 10 seconds. So let's move on to the structure of this paper. So the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to try and convince you of using new empirical evidence of the link between innovation and growth to try and give an empirical background for the models, you know, the Aguirre-Howitt, et cetera, models that we live on today. And then we're going to dive a little bit deeper into this innovation process, starting with the regional characteristics of these inventors. What was the environment in which they were born? So in particular, we're going to focus on things like population density, openness to disruption, as it's been postulated as important by a number of people, including some people in this room, and financial development. And we'll talk a little bit more in detail about what we mean by openness, disruption, et cetera, when we get there. Then we're going to dive into the personal backgrounds of these inventors. When are they most productive in terms of their life cycle? What does their marital status look like? How about their fertility and their migration patterns? Next, we're going to look at the family background of these inventors. How rich were their parents? How educated were their parents? And how educated were they? And which of these three effects seems to dominate in terms of determining inventive success? Next, we're going to look at what we term the return to innovation, the private return to innovation, by looking at the wage distribution of inventors versus non-inventors, and particularly successful inventors versus non-successful inventors. Now, of course, there's a caveat here. We're looking at wage income, and there might be plenty of other returns to innovation. For instance, if you can become an entrepreneur and you get some sort of utility or payoff from that, that might also be important. We're not going to be able to look at that today. And then we're also going to look at the life cycle of earnings of these people. Finally, we will look at return to the aggregate a little bit and look at the implications for state society, things like inequality and social mobility at the state and regional level. So because we have a lot of facts and I have an hour, I might not get to them all. And so I'm going to go through them very quickly here. So first, unsurprisingly, as we've been trying to say, more inventive states and sectors both grow faster on average. States which are more densely populated are also more inventive. And states which are more open to disruption are more inventive by a variety of measures, in particular the female labor force participation rate, the share of minorities with high-skilled jobs, religion, and slave ownership before the Civil War. Next, we look at the high-skilled migrant population, and states which have a lot of high-skilled migrants coming, bringing their new ideas, also seem to have higher invention rates. Next, states with more patents also have higher wages and lower income inequality by a number of measures. Finally, inventive states also exhibit greater social mobility. So you're more likely to end up with a high-skill job if your father was low-skill, if you're living in an inventive state versus in a non-inventive state. On the individual level, unsurprisingly, during this time, inventors were overwhelmingly white males. A disproportionate share of them were middle-aged and were most productive between 36 and 55 years old. Inventors are more likely to have migrated from their state of birth to seek pastures new and tend to be better educated and have higher skill occupations than non-inventors. I would say most of this is unsurprising. When we look at the family background, we see that those with inventor fathers might be marginally more likely to become inventors. However, the children of inventors do not themselves file more patents or are granted more patents conditional on being an inventor. So they are not necessarily of higher quality. Father's income is correlated with becoming an inventor, of course. However, when you control for the child's education, this effect disappears, suggesting that perhaps your own education matters more than your parental income. Higher education is positively correlated with inventor quality, conditioning on inventors, so you get more citations and patents if you are more educated. And successful patentees have substantially higher labor income, even when we control for all the things that we usually think contribute to labor income, things like occupation, education, age, etc. Inventors tend to delay marriage, but are more likely to be married at older ages, so perhaps a human capital story going on there. But they delay fertility and have fewer children on average. So these are basically our facts. So now we're going to return to our outline and look at trying to establish some sort of causal link, hopefully, or certainly a correlation between innovation and economic growth at a slightly aggregated level. So, of course, as mentioned, there is a 25-year-old endogenous growth literature trying to tie together innovation and aggregate growth, but the empirical evidence has been from modern studies, and we're looking at long-run growth is important because most of these models are indeed long-run models. So we're going to look at both state and sector-level performance using data from the BEA. And what we see is that inventive states rise up over the long run. So this is the growth rate between 1900 and 2000, 100 years, residualized against 1900 GDP per capita to allow for the fact that there is some natural convergent forces. And what you can see is that as states with more patents also have higher GDP per capita growth rates annualized between 1900 and 2000. So this is the first piece of evidence. And when we put this into a regression framework and control for population density as well, you can see a positive and significant relationship between patents and growth. Whether we look at patents or citations, there are a couple measures we can use to look at innovation. So how do we interpret these numbers? Well, this is exactly the same figure I showed you a second ago, and we're going to run the following exercise. We're going to take Massachusetts, see on the right, at about 0.2 on the y-axis, and we're going to take Wyoming, the furthest one on the left, and we're going to look at suppose that they had the same GDP at the beginning of the period, and the only thing that differed between them was their patents over this time frame. So if they didn't have any different patents, patent counts, their GDP per capita ratio would, of course, be one. There's nothing different between these two. They would have exactly the same output after 100 years. However, because of their different innovation levels, over the 100 years, Massachusetts has 30% higher output. 30% higher output than Wyoming over the 100 years in year 2000. So this is actually a large effect because this accumulates year on year as innovation accrues. Now, if we look at sectors, we see the same thing. So if we take the BEA data from 1948 to 1986 before they changed the SIC codes, and we run the same sort of exercise, and we look at value-added growth on the y-axis and total patents on the x-axis, again residualized against the initial level of value added, we see that more inventive sectors have higher growth in value added over these 40 years, both in value added and in employment. So innovation seems to have positive effects on the sector level as well as the state level. Now we could also look at this at a more shorter period of time and look at between 1947 and 1987. We again see the same thing at the state level. However, you might think there are plenty of endogeneity concerns here, of course. I mean, all sorts of things could be going on that would lead to both higher patent levels and higher growth rates. So to try and combat that, we're going to try and use something that's an instrument, of course. Ideally, we would have something that is not correlated with other things that determine growth. It only affects growth through the innovation levels. And for that, although there is no perfect instrument, we are going to try and use shifts in wartime government projects. So during World War II, the Office of Scientific Research and Development was established by Roosevelt, established in 1941 and terminated in 1947. Now the purpose of this office was to try and spur specific innovations. It gave contracts out to private bodies or universities in order to try and produce particular innovations that would help the wartime effort. So this includes many important things that we can see today, for instance, miniature electronics, which has been used a lot nowadays in the iPhone, for instance. It's a precursor to that, and the proximity fuse, navigation systems, rocket fuels, detonators, and of course, most famously, the basic science used in the Manhattan Project. Overall, the OSRD spent $450 million, about 6.5 times the federal budget for science in 1940. And it gave contracts out to a wide array of institutions and geographies. So Iowa State, for instance, received 10, University of New Mexico received 7, but also the Mellon Institute or DuPont Chemical, all of these places received contracts to innovate. So we went to the Library of Congress, and we collected data on all the contracts granted by the OSRD during its operation, and we used that to instrument for innovation during World War II, 1940 and 1945. And so we observe over 1,700 contracts across 39 US states. And when we run this instrumental variables regression, we find, in fact, something very, very similar to what we found on the OLS, about a 14% or 14 basis point increase in GDP growth rates if you increase patents by one lock point. Now, of course, there's no perfect instrument. You might have concerns about this one too, but we do run some exercises that help us at least sleep easy at night, which is running a placebo test where we instrument, instead of for wartime innovations, 1940 and 1945 patents, we instrument for the number of patents between 1935 and 1940. And we see absolutely no effect when we do that. So contracts are not picking up anything in terms of pre-existing trends or pre-existing innovative activity. It's really about this 1940 to 1945 innovative activity. Furthermore, when we put contracts on the left-hand side of variable as a dependent variable, and we regress it on GDP growth, either a standard annualized or the Davis-Holtzwanger-Shue measure, we find, again, no significant relationship between GDP growth and the number of contracts granted during World War II. So this at least helps us rest easy at night that it's not just a pre-existing trend that's picking up both the contracts and the patents. If we do this at a panel regression as well, so we look at five-year growth rates, we also see a robust positive relationship between innovation and growth. Yes? So the reason is twofold. First, we want to have a similar time frame to the sector data, which stops in 86 because of the SIC codes change. So just this to try for comparison purposes. And the second reason is that at around 1987, we start to see the dot-com boom really start to kick off. And there are the rise of things like patent trolls that we hear about a lot really introduces a lot of noise into the innovation measure. But really, the primary reason is for comparison purposes with the sector level work. Yes, correct. So yeah, perhaps we should look a little bit more into this, but regardless, our focus is on the long run growth. And I think that given that we've looked at 1900 to 2000 and another time frame between 1947 and 1987, we're relatively convinced that over the very long run, at least historically, there is a robust relationship between innovation and growth. So now that hopefully we've established the relationship, this relationship I've just mentioned, we're going to dive a little bit more into this innovation process. What is it that leads to inventors becoming inventors and inventing these great new technologies? So first we're going to look at the regional characteristics. To do that, I'm going to give you first a brief geography of these innovations. There's a big variation across the U.S. You can see that, indeed, California, Illinois, and the Northeast tend to be very inventive, whereas the South is less inventive. Lighter colors are less inventive, darker colors are more inventive. This is in 1880. When you look at 1900, 1910, 1920, et cetera, this pattern persists. So there is some persistence, although there is also some moving around, but the South tends to be less inventive than Northeast and California. So what are the characteristics of these innovative states besides the north-south divide? What's the characteristics of the cities and population density, the openness to disruption, and financial development? So why might population density matter? There's been a long literature dating back, well, not that long, actually, but an active literature really kicking off with Lucas in 2009, where close geographic proximity might contribute to the exchange of ideas, which is central to recombinations of ideas to build new ideas. And the growth of cities in particular, you know, Ed Glaser has a lot of work, and some people in this room, looking at the importance of cities as innovative hubs. And so we want to test that at a state and county level. So first we see that more inventive places, places that invented a lot between 1880 and 1940, have a lower proportion of their population living on farms. So innovation might be driving potentially this in sort of a Granger causality kind of way, the urbanization. But equally, places that are more urban in 1940 have more innovation between 1940 and 2004. So there's really a feedback effect that goes on here. This relationship is robust when we control for things like whether or not you was a Confederate state, the percentage of people who worked in an agricultural occupation, the percentage of people who worked in a manufacturing occupation. So even outside of the standard stories about occupation choice or north-south cultural divide, the more urban states are more inventive. In fact, a one standard deviation increase in the percent living in an urban area increases innovation by 33% relative to the mean once we control for the sector composition. So moving on to the openness to disruption, it's been postulated, as I say, that the ability of a society to adopt new ideas and discard the old ideas might be important for the way that we accept the incentives to innovate. So how much do societies tolerate these rebellious ideas and behavior? We're going to have a couple of measures for that. In particular, the female labor force participation in the workforce. At the time, females were largely marginalized, as were minorities. And so the participation in the labor market and the share of minorities with high-skilled jobs, we hope proxy the extent to which the society allows marginalized groups to operate and take part in growth. And then from a historical standpoint, the places which had high slave ownership, you might think were very resistant to change. We fought a war about that in the 1860s. And so that's going to be our third measure here. Now, you might worry that all these things are picking up the same thing, but the correlations between our measures are 0.3 or even 0.02. So they seem to be picking up slightly different aspects of openness. As given by my introduction, you would not be surprised to learn that places with higher female labor force participation rates also have more patents per capita between 1940 and 2004. So this is forward-looking. Similarly, for racially inclusive states and for slavery. So the percent of families owning slaves is on the x-axis here. On the y-axis, we have the patents per capita again. If we ignore all of these states that had zero slaves, we still see a robust negative relationship here. So it's not just driven by the zeros. It does seem like there is there's something going on about this is an intensive margin as well as extensive margin measure. When we put this into a regression framework, right now we're looking at the county level female labor force participation rate, and we control for things like state fixed effects and again the occupational choice. We again find a positive relationship between female labor force participation and patents per capita. And similarly, we find a robust relationship at the state level for the slave ownership, and even within just the Confederate states. So we think that there's something to this openness disruption literature that has been ongoing, and yes. Moving on to banking and finance, there's obviously a large literature that's been devoted to understanding the link between finance and innovation. You might think that innovation requires some startup costs, and the ability of people to finance those startup costs, as we saw in the case of Edison, might really impact the extent to which areas can become innovative. So we're going to focus on bank lending in 1920 because we want to avoid sort of the Depression era. And we have data from 1920 to about 1936. The data comes from the FDIC. And what we see is, unsurprisingly, that the number of bank deposits per capita in 1920 is positively correlated with the future innovation between 1920 and 1930. Similarly, if we look at the number of bank failures, that is going to be negatively associated. So the health of the banking sector does seem to matter, as postulated in models such as Aguillon and Tirole and Rajan Zingales. For innovation and investment. So now we're going to move on to the more micro data things. So we're going to look at the personal backgrounds of these inventors, the age, marriage, children, and migration status. So this is really one of the unique features of this paper, is that we are able to match these individual inventors to their family backgrounds and their own backgrounds to shed light on the demographics. Unsurprisingly, inventors are disproportionately white and male relative to the average U.S. population. And that's mirrored in this bar graph showing the inventors per 10,000 by race. So just over two inventors per 10,000 people among the white population, relative to under a half of an inventor per 10,000. So it's about 4 to 5 times more likely to be an inventor if you're white. You're also more likely to be middle-aged, whether you're female or male. So the males are the sort of blue line graphs. They're on the left axis. Females are on the right axis. First, you can notice that the axis labels are very different. Males are much more likely to be inventors. And the second thing to notice is that the bars are tallest in the 36 to 55 age groups. However, they also marry later in life than non-inventors. So while there might be an initial bit of catch-up that needs to happen, as the inventors are really investing in their career and their inventions, you know, the sort of Nikola Tesla story of being an asocial focused on their work, later on in life, they find a spouse and, I guess, live happily ever after in these times. However, they do have fewer children, both sort of early in life and later on. So the demographics are somewhat mixed compared to the rest of the population. That's showing the same thing. So now we focus on migration, mobility, geographic mobility. Using data from from the census, we see exactly where someone was born, and we know where they are at the time of the census. So we can construct measures of cumulative migration over the life cycle, so whether or not you are living somewhere different to where you were born. There's been a growing literature on this, including some work on, again, people in this room, that's been looking on the incentive effects of taxes, et cetera, on inventor mobility and the location choices that might lead to this. So when do inventors move in their life cycle and where do they move? Well, we can first see that they are more mobile than non-inventors. And what's more, the gap really opens up right around the middle-aged time of their life, which is when the inventors are most productive. So inventors that are middle-aged really are more likely to move than non-inventors. And you might think, okay, maybe it's just because of their high skill, but if we look within high-skill occupations, this effect persists. So it's not just a skill level thing. There is really something about moving to where the market is, moving to where the resources are, that is special about inventors. And where do they move? In these graphs, we have on the x-axis the characteristic of the source state and the destination state of these inventors. So for instance, this dot would suggest be looking at people who have 8% of minorities with a high skill occupation in their birth state move to places with, on average, 2% of minorities having a high skill occupation. So in the top left, we look at the migration of people to urban areas. And because we can see the large number of these dots are above the 45-degree line, we can claim that the majority of inventors move from less urban areas to more urban areas. Similarly, they move from less financially developed to more financially developed states, less slave-owned states to more, or sorry, other way around, states with a high share of slave ownership to a low share of slave ownership. So, and states with a low share of minorities with high skill occupations to high share of minorities with high skill occupations. So there's some sense in which they are both moving to more open societies, more closely densely populated societies, and places where it's easier for them to get financing. This is really driven by the high skill migrants. So if you look at international migrants, when we control for things like state fixed effects, age, et cetera, international migrants are not more likely to become inventors unless they are high skill. You hear a lot about the Chinese railroad workers coming in the late 1800s, early 1900s. These were not the guys who were inventing. It was more like the scientists fleeing Germany to escape the war, for instance. Next, we're going to move on to the family background. Yes? Yes.
If you do the same by state of origin of the inventors, do you get roughly the same facts? Have you looked into this already?
That's a good question. I think we'll need to look at that a little bit more, but that's a good question. I'll add that to my list. So next we're going to look at the family background and education. So the role of education is commonly accepted as being an important driver of growth, going back to Kenneth Arrow and Lucas, and it's really a workhorse, human capital development, a workhorse of economic growth. Is it also a workhorse of innovation? Well, there is some evidence on this, including Murat's job market paper and the paper by Aguirre et al., Ufuk, and Otto Toivonen, who's here, looking at exhibiting a strong link between upbringing and human capital formation, and indeed a link between human capital formation and innovation. So indeed, using microdata from Finland, Aguirre et al. Show that the probability of becoming an inventor is driven by father's income, parental education, own education, and IQ. We don't observe IQ, but we can replicate these facts in the U.S. In our time period as well. So this is a graph that's very similar to the Bell et al. Paper, and Xavier has been working on it as well, showing that the parental income percentile on the x-axis and the number of inventors per 10,000 on the y-axis on the left and citations per 10,000 on the right. And we can see it's a relatively flat relationship for a large portion of the income distribution. However, at the very top of the income distribution, people are much more likely to become inventors. So maybe there's something about being very rich that helps contribute to innovation, creativity. Maybe it removes the shackles of you know, making ends meet. Yes.
Have you looked at a similar graph focusing on the really superstar inventors? So it seems that one thing that you have is really unique to your data set. Mm-hmm. Focus on Edison, all these examples of really fantastic inventors, which we can't do, for instance, in the more recent period. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we have done that. I don't have it here, but the answer is that it is still a convex relationship. It's just not nearly this strong. There's a lot more noise present. Of course, we don't really have the trouble with going into these superstars is that they become more case studies. You know, the sample sizes drop pretty quickly because there aren't that many Thomas Edisons in the world, unfortunately, I suppose. But the answer to the question is there is still convexity, just not nearly as strong. But we can talk afterwards. If we look at education, we also see the same thing, that more educated individuals are more likely to have more citations and more likely to become an inventor. So what if we were to put all of these things on the right-hand side in a regression, run a horse race, which one of these effects dominates? So here, the left-hand side variable is just an indicator for whether or not you are an inventor, scaled by a factor of 100 for legibility. And the first thing to note is this first couple of columns, which show that there is maybe a marginal effect at best of your father being an inventor. Maybe they can pass on some knowledge or bring you into the business or something, particularly if you're a firstborn son. However, it's not statistically significant, and with 82 million observations, that suggests that this is at best a marginal effect. However, when we look at income, as is mirrored by the graphs, there is a statistically significant effect, which is large relative to the mean of the dependent variable, which is about 0.01, from your father being exceedingly wealthy. We also include controls for this is relative to the below median income. We also include controls for other income levels, but not shown here for brevity. When we control for father's education does seem to matter, but it does not take away much of the effect of your father's income. So father's income still does matter. It's not just about your education mattering in the sense it's a better proxy for wealth. It's not just that it's genes coming through and education's a proxy for intelligence. It's the father's income still has a bite after this education. However, when we control for your own education, if you yourself go to college or high school, you're more likely to become an inventor, and your father's income no longer matters. So this suggests that perhaps there's some sort of credit constraint story where people might be wanting to go to college, but they can't afford it unless their father is wealthy. And once, no matter how wealthy you are, once you go to college, that effect washes away. When we look on the intensive margin, when we look at the universe of inventors and how many patents are they granted over their life cycle, the first thing to note is that this father-inventor variable now flags up negative and significant, meaning that once you are an inventor, if your father was also an inventor, they're not handing off tips of the trade. It might be more that they're bringing you in without you being a good match to invention. Is there a question back there? And the second thing to note is that the education, at least higher education, still matters on the intensive margin of innovativeness, innovation. So this result of the father's inventor having a negative relationship with the number of patents granted is reminiscent of the findings by Perez Gonzalez, who show that wasteful nepotism. So the idea is that incoming CEOs who got the job because their parents were the CEO do a worse job at running their company, and this has been replicated by Bloom and Van Reenen in India, and we've shown a similar sort of pattern exists in inventors. Yes?
Is another introduction finding sort of a barrier to entry, that your father is not an inventor and you're still making it to invention, then you have to be very good. So it's not really about nepotism, it's just about the fact that some people manage to get into the innovation world even without the connections. But more related to the Pino, Hurst, and others, this paper on misallocation of talent.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good point. And you know, we could probably look at that to a certain extent by looking at things like population density. If you think that these connections really matter, you would expect the connections to matter more for people who don't move out of their home state where their fathers are, for instance.
Do you find that the low-income children who make it into innovation tend to get the most sites? Is this fact also true for across the income distribution or more for this inventor, non-inventor?
It's more for the inventor, non-inventor, I think. I mean, you can see that the father's income doesn't really matter, at least on this measure. When you stratify by occupation skill, I don't think we find much to. So, but you might be right. There might be other sorts of connections that are not captured by income, but are captured by the inventive community or something that could be at play here. Next, we're going to go into, again, what I call the return to innovation, again, with an asterisk that we're only capturing a small piece of the return by looking at the wage distribution. So this is a relatively thin literature because you really need good microdata on earnings and inventiveness to look at this. Although there are these three new papers looking at data from the IRS or from Finland that exhibit that there is indeed a return to innovating, that you do end up earning more after an invention. And we find the same thing. So on the x-axis, we have the citation-weighted patent count quantile. So how many citations do your patents receive? That's a measure of patent quality. And on the y-axis, we have your log wage income. And we can see a robust positive relationship between the two. And indeed, when we run this in a regression and we look at we observe the wage in 1940 census only. So what we're looking at here is the patents before 1940 and after 1940. And we want to see, okay, there are two stories that could be going on here. Perhaps these inventions are higher type. The number of patents you have is a signal to your employer that you are going to be a high type person, and therefore you need to be paid more to compensate to keep you. Or it could be that after you innovate, that then reveals your type and the, sorry, no, after you innovate, that reveals your type and you receive the returns from the invention, et cetera. And so breaking it out into pre and post will get us a little way into that measure. So we see that there's a positive relationship between both the pre and the post inventiveness and 1940 wages. But we see a stronger effect on the post-1940 inventiveness. So what that means is that there's more of an effect from the anticipation of future productivity than the realization of past productivity. And this is controlling for things like age and education, as you would expect. So now just to look at the more distributional aspects of it, rather than just the mean, we can see that inventors have higher wages. However, there might be 100 different things going on here. So when we want to control for things like education, state fixed effects, occupation, sex, age, race, and migrant status. And then when we plot the residuals from a regression on those controls, we still have a right shift in the income distribution for inventors relative to non-inventors. So there's something about invention outside of the occupation you have that really leads to an extra return in terms of wages. Inventors also have a steeper life cycle earnings profile. That's perhaps unsurprising given what I've just shown. And now, since I'm slightly running out of time, I'm going to try and scoot to the last part of the talk, looking at sort of the effect on society of these innovations, looking at inequality and social mobility. So how does this inventiveness relate to income inequality? The argument can go in both ways. There's a class of models that show that postulate that perhaps incumbents might be getting stronger and stronger as time goes on, and that will then lead to a more unequal society as the people who continue to innovate, get richer and richer while the people at the bottom do not. However, there might also be, and in fact there's some empirical evidence to suggest that that's going on nowadays from the Aguirre et al. Paper cited here. However, if innovations generate turnover, for instance, if new entrants come in and displace incumbents, if the creative destruction process is working the way it should, perhaps it can be a motive or an engine for moving up through the society's ranks. And this is shown by postulated by Chad Jones and Kim. In our data, we find that more inventive states have a compressed income distribution, at least historically, by a number of measures. So the first measure we're going to show you is the 90 to 10 wage income ratio in 1940, so the 90th percentile to the 10th percentile of wages. And we see the places that have more innovation per capita have lower income inequality. If we look at the Gini coefficient, another measure of inequality, we find exactly the same picture. Then when we condition on observables, we still find the significant negative relationship between patents per capita and the 90 to 10 ratio, less so on the Gini coefficient. But there does seem to be at least there's still a negative coefficient, just insignificant. So there might be some sort of relationship here, at least in our data, between innovation and lower wage income inequality. In terms of economic magnitude, the one standard deviation in patents per capita decreases the 90 to 10 ratio by 8.2% of the mean. So it's a fairly large effect. When we look at the top 1% share, which is something what Aguirre et al. Was looking at, we find a negative relationship between innovation and inequality for a subset of states. But after a certain point, we find an increasing relationship. There's this sort of U-shape or piecewise linear relationship. There might be some sort of threshold over which the amount of innovation only accrues to certain kinds of people and reverses the result we saw in the 90 to 10 ratio. So the top 1% really get rich, even if the 90 to 10 ratio is getting compressed. You might think, okay, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, heavy financial sectors, that persists even if we throw out everyone who is in the financial sector. Now, in terms of social mobility, we have one measure that we like quite a bit, which is the fraction of people who have a low-skill father who themselves are high skill. There's some variation in this over both time and space. In 1880, you can see that there are some socially mobile places like New Jersey and California, but really there's not that much social mobility, partially because high-skill jobs were hard to come by. Over time, this picture gets a lot darker. There are a lot more there's a lot more social mobility in the U.S. in general. The American dream comes to life. But the places that stayed, that were socially mobile in the previous picture, are still socially mobile in this picture. New York, California, New Jersey, Illinois to an extent. And indeed, we find that picture actually looked pretty similar to the patents per capita picture I showed you earlier. And indeed, in the scatter plot, if we look across all states, we see a positive relationship between innovation and our measure of social mobility, which survives conditional on observables as well. So to conclude, I think this is really the first paper. It's a very descriptive paper in what I believe is an exciting research agenda to come. We've documented the link between innovation and growth and some of the characteristics of innovative regions and inventors in the U.S. during the golden age, so to speak. However, we've only presented casual causal evidence of certainly the determinants of innovation. And I think that there's a lot more that can be done on this long run stuff, and hopefully this new microdata is a great new tool for research going forward. So thank you very much.